Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 23rd of May. This Monday, we mark Memorial Day, and we are marking the day early here on our program as we won't be with you live on Monday, but we will on Monday be presenting an award-winning documentary that has been compiled mainly by Mike Simonson, our reporter out of the Superior Bureau. It's a two-hour documentary that he has compiled, Forever Ace, the Richard Bong story, and it features interviews with Bong's wingman, tentmate, and crew chief during his service in the South Pacific. It is a remarkable documentary. Mike is a superb reporter, so we are honored to air that for a full 2 hours on Memorial Day. Mike will join us at the end of this hour. This day, we're going to concentrate on World War II, where more than 16 million American men and women served. And today, as you know, there are fewer than 2 million veterans who remain, and they are dying at the rate of 800 every day. We have as our guest this hour Rick Atkinson, who's an award-winning writer, reporter, and author of several books. Indeed, he has put together a trilogy on World War II. It's about 3,000 words, and the last book has just been released, and we're talking about it. It's The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe, 1944 to 1945, Volume 3 of the Liberation Trilogy. For those of you who have loved ones who served in World War II, memories of World War II, perhaps you served in World War II, we welcome your thoughts this hour of the program. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages for us there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Rick Atkinson, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Yes.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. 14 years for the trilogy. That's a long time, sir.
Yeah, in some ways it flew by in the blink of an eye, but yes, 14 years. I started in earnest in January of 1999. Volume 1 was published in 2002 and Volume 2 in 2007. So this last one, which is just out last week, was the hardest nut, as you might expect, because it's the biggest part of the war. The war really gets enormous by the time we get to Normandy.
Yeah. Now, you're an Army brat, didn't you? Were you born in Germany?
I was. I was born in Munich. My father was an infantry officer. I'm still alive. He'll be 89 years old.
And oh.
At the time, we actually lived in Salzburg in Austria because the American Army was still in Austria as part of the occupation, and we were there for the first 3 years of my life. And then I lived in Berlin as a correspondent for the Washington Post for 3 years in the mid-90s.
Are there any memories that are front and present in Berlin now?
Oh, my gosh. The war is everywhere in Berlin, even the newly reconstructed Berlin. There are memorials to this and that everywhere. The concentration camps are very much present.
Mm-hmm.
There's a camp just north of Berlin. There's a church that was destroyed in the bombing that's been left on the Kurfürstendamm, the main avenue in western Berlin. And you can't pass through Berlin, even in a transitory way, without seeing some reminder of the war.
I am absolutely astounded. I had never seen this in print before, that 16 million American men and women served in that war. What a huge number.
16.1 million
Ooh.
In a country of 130 million. So everyone had skin in the game. Everyone had someone they loved who was in harm's way. It's quite remarkable when you contrast it to our current day, where we've got a country of about 313 million, and there are about 2 million in uniform if you count the Guard and Reserve. So it's quite a sea change in terms of the emotional investment that we Americans had during the war.
We did an interview a couple weeks ago with the author of the really superb book on FDR and Charles Lindbergh, Lynn Olson's book. And it was interesting to me to read that there was a great deal of opposition to entry into the war. I'm wondering from your research, what was a turning point? What was it that made men and women say this is a cause worth fighting for? And they signed up for the most part in huge numbers. Eventually there was a shortage. But there was so much opposition and concern. What turned the tide?
Well, two words, Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
There was opposition both politically, And grassroots folks just felt that we did not want to get involved and entangled in another European brawl. And it took Pearl Harbor to reverse that virtually overnight. And yes, there were mass enlistments, but it's important to remember that of those 16.1 million, the overwhelming number of them were drafted. They didn't necessarily volunteer to go, public sentiment turned around very quickly. There was a desire for revenge against the Japanese, and of course, Hitler and the Germans declared war on us shortly after Pearl Harbor. So at that point, Roosevelt's problems, which had caused him to try to finesse assistance to the British and the other Western allies, evaporated in the sense that people were now ready, fully committed, and determined to bring the war to a successful conclusion.
I know that you have observed very close hand other wars that we've been involved in, and I'm always interested in what is it that can get a person to fight and to kill. In World War II, was it Pearl Harbor that was front and center? Was it the Band of Brothers, the people you were working with? Was it Hitler? What was it?
Well, generally, I think men, and now men and women, fight for each other. The camaraderie of a military unit or the camaraderie of shared hardship and sacrifice is the greatest motivator, and you don't want to be less than the man or the man and woman on your left and on your right. And I think that combined with able leadership, that's part of the test of leadership, to be able to motivate people to risk their lives and to put themselves in jeopardy. Those are the primary things. You know, the large issues of democracy and freedom and the four freedoms in Roosevelt's case, and a sense of revenge against the Japanese. Those play a part, but I think fundamentally they are ancillary to the larger issue of fighting because those with you are fighting.
I've often thought about what the world would be if we had lost that war. Do you think about that?
I do. It's counterfactual, and historians tend to shy away from those.
Right.
But it would have been a very different world, needless to say. It was an existential war, and that's important, I think, for understanding how you get 16 million people to row the boat in the same direction. There was a recognition that our very way of life, if not the very existence of the United States, was at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of Roosevelt's genius, I think. He made Americans understand, ultimately, even though there had been great resistance before December 1941, he made Americans understand that the stakes couldn't be higher, and that helps to organize not only the armed forces and have it grow from 190,000 in 1938, where we're the 17th most powerful military in the world, right behind that perennial powerhouse Romania, to an armed forces of 16.1 million, and with the arsenal of democracy, as he called it, cranking out hundreds of thousands of airplanes and ultimately millions of tanks and trucks and other war vehicles, not only for us, but for our allies in the Western Alliance, particularly the British and the Soviet Union and the French.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to 1944, December of 1944. How organized and powerful were the Nazis?
Well, they'd been fighting in earnest since 1939 and they'd been preparing for war before that. They'd had some reverses, needless to say, and that's what I write about earlier in the trilogy, the reversals in North Africa. That's really where the liberation of Europe begins. And then reversals farther north in the Mediterranean, on Sicily, where they're evicted in July and August of 1943. And then in Italy, where their ally, Mussolini and the fascists in Italy, are overthrown. And Italy is essentially liberated as far as Rome by June of 1944. But having said that, Hitler's still got an enormous army. He's got a country that's largely still behind him. He's got enormous problems in the east, with the Soviet Union bearing down on him, he having invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941. So to say that they're dangerous and they're powerful doesn't begin to capture how large this predicament is if you're trying to land on a hostile shore in, say, Normandy in June of 1944.
And the Allies were confident that victory was close or not?
You know, by June of 44, when the invasion is about to take place, there is a confidence that the war is going to be won eventually. The question at that point is, how costly will it be? How long will it take? What will the end game look like? I think it's important to remember that the war is awful virtually to the last gunshot. In April 1945, the last full month of the war in Europe, more than 10,000 American soldiers were killed in action in Germany. That's goodness. Almost as many as died in June 1944, the month of invasion. So this is a very, very bloody, difficult 11 months from the invasion of Normandy to the final surrender on May 8th, 1945 in Europe. And no one from Eisenhower and Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt on down had any illusions that it was going to be simple, easy, or anything other than sanguinary.
Mm-hmm. Who was the mastermind or the masterminds behind Normandy? When you think about it, what an incredible operation to organize and to have faith that it was going to be successful.
Well, the planning had gone on since really early in 1942 in one form or another. And there was a British general in 1943 named Morgan who did a lot of the planning and looked specifically at Normandy, which was not the most obvious place to land. The Pas-de-Calais, which is farther north and closer to England, is the obvious beachhead. When it came down to planning specifically Operation Overlord, which is the invasion that took place in June of 44, the main planner is the guy who's largely in charge of executing him. That's Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery. Eisenhower is the overall commander. He has returned to England from the Mediterranean theater in January of 1944, and so he's overseeing it. It's his plan. If it fails, he takes the blame. In fact, he wrote a note apologizing, just in case he had to release it to the press should the invasion fail. But it's really Montgomery who's looking specifically at the issues of landing craft and the troop ratios and casualties and overseeing the 1,001 details and the minutiae of this incredibly complex choreography.
And the relationship between Eisenhower and American officers and Montgomery was not the smoothest of relationships.
No, that's putting it mildly. Yeah, there have been friction, first of all, in the senior ranks of the American Army. There's a deep Anglophobia, a distrust and a dislike of the British for various reasons, including, frankly, small-mindedness by some of the Americans. And that had been exacerbated starting in North Africa, and it was aggravated in Sicily, where Montgomery, all of these guys, senior commanders, are coming out of the Mediterranean. They call themselves the Mediterraneanites. They're deeply imprinted by their experiences in Africa and Italy. And by the time we get to Normandy, there are some real clashes that by the end of 1944 have turned into ruptures and threatened to really pull apart the alliance in a pretty significant way. Eisenhower, you have to say, was extraordinary in his ability to turn the other cheek in the face of insolence or impertinence, which Montgomery could dish out with the best of them. Montgomery had real gifts. The success in Normandy should be attributed to him as much as to any individual. But he's insufferable in many ways. And you found that somebody like Omar Bradley, who's the senior ground commander for the Americans, who likes and respects Montgomery reasonably well at the time of the invasion in Normandy, just can't stand him, can hardly stand to be in the room with him by the time we get to early 1945.
I had never heard, and you write about this in the book, that somebody had thought of building a tunnel across the English Channel?
Yeah, you know, if you recognize that invading by sea is going to be hazardous because there are many Germans waiting for you on or near the beaches, and that coming by air, by parachute, or by glider is also going to be hazardous, what are your alternatives? Well, somebody had the notion, well, maybe we can dig a tunnel under the English Channel. And there was a study done, and the guys who did the study reported back, yes, we can do this. It'll take 15,000 miners a year to excavate 50,000 tons of spoil, but we can do it. The one thing they couldn't finesse, that they could never figure out, is what happens when that first tunneler pops his head out of the tunnel in Normandy and the entire German 7th Army is waiting for him.
Right. It's amazing that somebody even thought of it at that time. We welcome phone calls for our guest, and we'll take them momentarily. We are marking Memorial Day early on Monday. Next Monday during our hours, we're very pleased to present a documentary that has been put together and has already won awards. Mike Simonson from Superior, our Superior Bureau, has compiled a two-hour documentary, Forever Ace, the Richard Bong story, featuring interviews with many, many people who were with him during his service in the South Pacific. It was compiled, this documentary, from 10 years of interviews and is well worth listening to on Memorial Day. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to leave a message there, The Kathleen Dunn Show. The guest this hour, Rick Atkinson, final in the trilogy about World War II, The Guns at Last Light, The War in Europe, 1944 to 1945, is the final volume of his Liberation Trilogy, released last week. It's a narrative history of the U.S. military's role in the liberation of Europe in World War II. The first volume, maybe you've read some of these, An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942 to 43, received the Pulitzer and was acclaimed as the best World War II battle narrative since Cornelius Ryan's classics, The Longest Day and A Bridge Too Far. Second volume, The Day of Battle, The War in Sicily and Italy, 1943 to 1944. Atkinson, also the best-selling author of The Long Gray Line, which is a narrative about the West Point class of 1966, and Crusade, a narrative history of the Persian Gulf War. We'll welcome your phone calls. Later this hour, Mike Simonson will join us and tell us about his documentary. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now. Let us start with Bill in Westby. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hey, I was just wondering, you know, the first 20 minutes of that movie, Saving Private Ryan, is maybe the most intense war movie ever filmed. And I was just wondering if that was accurate. And I also was wondering, what is your author's favorite World War II movie?
Oh, thanks, Bill. I think that 20 or 22 minutes in the Steven Spielberg movie, and the cinematographer is the great Janusz Kaminski, is probably about as close to most people can come to that sort of intense combat without actually being in it. It's extraordinarily accurate in terms of how vivid it is, and it captures the melange of emotions of fear, and if not terror, and confusion. The noise that you hear on that soundtrack is quite accurate. Having been in combat with the 101st Airborne Division, for example, in Iraq in 2003, the noise is something that most people underappreciate. So my hat's off to Spielberg and Kaminski for the depiction of it. My favorite World War II movie, probably 12 O'Clock High. I think that's an extraordinary studying character and stress and command. I like Saving Private Ryan a lot at the beginning. I think it kind of devolves into a buddy movie. I don't think that it holds up with the brilliance that you see there at the beginning. But to be honest with you, there aren't a whole lot that I place in the first rank of movies. The Best Years of Our Lives, about veterans coming home after the war, I think is really one of the greatest
excellent
movies
film.
Ever made.
Yeah, it's a great film. Thank you very much for the call, Bill. There were, you, I think have published this. Not many people have. Some of the stuff is, well, the whole thing was terribly frightening. But you write about there being plans for chemical warfare in Normandy that maybe it hasn't been published before, has it?
No, I found, along with a number of other things, things that are, I think, quite new. The Americans and British stockpiled 160,000 tons of chemical munitions in England and in the Mediterranean.
Ooh.
For use, and that's a lot of chemicals, for use in case chemical warfare erupted, as it certainly had in World War I. And I found at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, the two plans that had been drafted and approved by Eisenhower for chemical warfare in Normandy, should that break out. And that typically would require the Germans to use it first. One of the plans, in essence, took into account concern about French civilian casualties. The second plan didn't take that into account at all. Basically, the feeling was that if the second plan had been enacted, we weren't going to worry about French civilian casualties. It was Katie bar the door when it came to dropping chemicals and other kinds of munitions like airdrop chemical bombs all across Normandy. There would have been thousands, maybe tens of thousands of French casualties had it come to that.
Mm. And there was also a plan by the Germans to infect England with the bubonic plague from rats?
Well, there was concern about that. And it turns out the Germans had many nefarious schemes. That happened not to be one of them, but there was anxiety among the planners before D-Day that the Germans would drop rats from airplanes. And consequently, there were bounties offered on rat carcasses in England so that they could be tested for plague. There was also concern that they would drop something vaguely called radioactive agents, and there were Geiger counters hidden all over London so that suspected radioactivity could be detected. There were many anxieties about what the Germans could do to disrupt this vast undertaking of several million men assembling very secretly, really, in England for the purpose of crossing the English Channel and beginning the invasion of France. And at that point, they were probably more vulnerable than at any other, except perhaps on the beaches themselves. And so you have to say the planners let their imaginations run wild in some cases.
How do you gather secretly several million men?
Well, yes, how do you indeed on an island as small as,
right,
as Britain? Well, of course, the Germans were aware that there had been a buildup in England, really beginning in 1942 with respect to the Americans. What they don't know is that the assembly of both men and the landing craft that are going to carry them and all of the other incidentals that go into this huge armada, they don't know that it's really beginning to mass in southern England and southeastern England, because in part there's an enormous deception operation. It's led by the British. It's called Operation Fortitude. It's brilliant. It's quite effective. And the Germans are blind to some extent. They don't have good aerial reconnaissance. They can't get their planes over to take photos of the English coastline. There are agents, and they have a number of agents in England. They've all been captured and turned by the British so that they are, unbeknownst to Berlin, feeding false information back to their handlers via Lisbon for the most part. And consequently, there is quite a lot of success in keeping the Germans duped about when and where the invasion is going to occur.
Hmm. Priscilla is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Priscilla.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to tell you I am on page 140 of the book.
Great.
I pre-ordered it through Amazon, and it came in the mail this week, and I was so excited to finally see it. I have read the other two books, and I think they are outstanding. But you addressed in the book an issue that has always bothered me since I'm still in Normandy in the book. How you said that it was a failure of command planning, but that doesn't tell me quite enough how they were not prepared to deal with the bocage, the terrain of Normandy once they got off the beaches. I mean, that stuff had been there for 1,000 years. How could they not be prepared to deal with it?
Yeah, how indeed. Thanks, Priscilla. And what you're alluding to is the peculiar growth of very dense hedges, particularly on the western part of the Normandy invasion area. And it's almost impenetrable. Those who had been fighting in South Pacific at Guadalcanal and so on, and were now fighting in Normandy for the Americans, were reminded very much of the jungles of the South Pacific. And there was an intellectual appreciation of it. Of course, there were terrain studies done, and you can read various reports about what the geography of Normandy is like, and every little town has reports done on it. But so much attention is given to getting onto the beach and then getting off the beach. And the ambition really in the first day or so is to get 5 to 7 miles beyond the waterline so that you can push German artillery back far enough so that they can't fire artillery onto the beaches. And we've seen this earlier. It's the same phenomenon occurs in Sicily, for example, where there's so much attention and so much energy given to the beach landings and the immediate aftermath of establishing a beachhead that not a lot of thought is given subsequently. And so when they begin to push down into Normandy, push south, and particularly over in the American sector, they come into this god-awful stuff. And these bocage hedges, these hedgerows, had been created, as you say, over 1,000 years, basically by French farmers pushing debris and rocks and so on off to one side of their field so that it forms essentially a kind of dike. And out of this grow mulberry trees and a real thicket. Hmm. And it took some ingenuity, and it didn't happen really until the middle of July, more than a month after the invasion, to figure out how to get through these things. And there were a lot of men who died because of the oversight in trying to think this through clearly enough.
Hmm. Well, especially since it had happened before, I guess it's what bothers me. And carrying it into the present world, it sometimes seems that those lessons of planning after the very beginning have not exactly been learned.
Well, I think that's a good. I think that's a good point you're making. There's certain things about warfare that are eternal. The life of an infantryman, for example, in 1944 would be very familiar to an infantryman in Afghanistan today or back in Thucydides' day. And failures to think through certain things, to have the vision that allows you to anticipate problems, like in this case the bocage, that's very much part of what is generally called the fog of war. There's confusion and failure to anticipate, so you're absolutely right.
Thank you, Priscilla, so much for your call. Paul in Middleton, hi.
Good morning to you both. I want to thank Mr. Atkinson for chronicling, I guess through military records, my father's military career from December 7th. My dad was at Schofield Barracks, Territory of Hawaii on that day, all the way through North Africa in Operation Torch, on to Sicily, and then on to Salerno, where he was on the first wave of the initial assault, and then up the Italian boot until June 5th, when the first Axis capital fell. Of course, that was all lost later because June 6th was D-Day. And no one thought second to the thoughts about Italy at that point. But the Italian campaign was a brutal campaign. And a lot of men died because of that rather odd Churchillian notion that it was the soft underbelly of Europe. And if anybody studied military history, you know you invaded Italy from the north to the south, not from the south to the north.
Mm. Paul,
because
did you...
it was like one, it was one mountain after another, after another, after another. And my father... well, he endured a lot. He was an infantry officer with the 36th Texas Division and lost a lot of men for no reason.
Did he talk to you about all of this, Paul, or not?
more of the absurdities of it, even though my father was a, when he joined, was a $21 a month professional in the Army. But more the absurdities. For example, there was a guy in his outfit, in his platoon, who I guess was not the most machismo of guys, and they all nicknamed him Mary. Well, Mary took a shot to the helmet and the head, and they sent him back to the aid station, and they figured that was the last they'd ever seen of Mary. Well, a little bit later, I was coming up the road, but Mary, and my dad turns to him and says, "Mary, what the hell are you doing here?" And he says, "Well, here you go, Lieutenant." And it was a disposition from the aid station back that he was fit to report for combat, but that the service member should not put any heavy objects on his head.
Oh, my. Rick.
Well, you're right, Paul, that it sounds like your father had quite a war. The 36th Division, which had been the Texas National Guard, saw extraordinary fighting at Salerno, and then particularly the Rapido River. There were more than 2,000 casualties at the Rapido in January 1944. There were 23,000 American soldiers killed in Italy during the war. It was an awful, bloody gut, and there were many who wondered, particularly after the Italian campaign was swept off the front pages, as you say, with Rome falling on June 4th, 1944, and then, of course, Normandy is invaded on June 6th. All eyes swivel to Normandy, and even though the war goes on for almost another year in Italy, and it's awful, it's fighting in the Apennines in the winter again, there's not a lot of attention given to it. And those who stuck it out, the 36th Division, of course, was part of the force that then invaded southern France in August of 44. I write about that a lot because most Americans don't know about that campaign across the Côte d'Azur, Saint-Tropez, and then up the Rhone River and through the Vosges Mountains. It's an extraordinary part of the liberation of Europe, and your dad's division was all part of that.
Thank you, Paul, so much. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks thanks to both of you, and congratulations on your work, sir. I'm really looking forward to reading it. What I'd like to ask about is, as I understand it, the Air Corps of the United States and England had much different philosophies in terms of the U.S. flew in the daytime and the Brits flew at night. And as my understanding is that was because the Brits believed that it was safer for their air crews to fly with the cover of darkness. And I guess my question is, who do you think had the better philosophy there in terms of the loss versus what you gained from daytime flying? And I'd also like to know, was there ever any coordination between the two air corps, like doing attacks on the same places, day and night, that kind of mission?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Scott. Yes, there was a debate and a difference of philosophies that had begun in 1942 about how best to use the strategic air arms of the British and the Americans. These are the big heavy bombers, basically. The B-17, for example, in the case of the Americans, for the most part, B-24. The Americans did believe that flying in daylight allowed for better accuracy. The British believed, with some reason, that flying at night made it harder for the Germans to see them, to shoot them down. It was really not until the introduction of the P-51 Mustang escort fighter, which had long range and was very maneuverable, it was a very, very tough fighter plane, that the American philosophy was proven to be, for the Americans at least, to be worthy of the force, because there had been very heavy losses before the P-51s came into England, really, in numbers. You had a kind of synergy, really. You had forces flying out of both England and Italy, bombing the fatherland and satellites. You had forces flying during the day and forces flying at night, round-the-clock bombing, essentially. And yes, there was often a coordinated effort. The two forces didn't agree on some things. The Americans, for example, in the spring of 1944, came to believe that oil was the real Achilles heel
of the Third Reich, and that was accurate. That was true, and that's what really brought them to their knees. And the Americans hammered those oil targets. The Brits tended to resist that. Bomber Command believed that hitting cities would bring the Germans to their knees. But, for example, the bombing of Dresden, the famous firebombing in February of 1945, those were British planes that hit Dresden first, but then they were followed by American planes the next day. And that was quite common for the two forces to collaborate like that.
And we should also say that the book is filled with stories. You can't think about the bombing of Dresden without thinking about Kurt Vonnegut and his extraordinary writing about that.
That's true. Kurt Vonnegut, a young infantry soldier from Indiana, finds himself in the 106th Infantry Division in the Belgian Ardennes in December 1944, when the Germans launched something that comes to be known as the Battle of the Bulge. And the 106th Division was essentially destroyed. Mm-hmm. Two regiments were largely captured or killed. And Vonnegut was one of those who was captured, and he's hustled off to a camp, and he's in a work detail in Dresden, and so he witnesses the firebombing that I just alluded to in February of 45, and it is the basis for writing the novel Slaughterhouse Five.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott, as always. Nice to hear from you. Nancy in Madison, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling with a comment, really. I bought the book last week. I'm well into it. It's just fascinating. I purchased it, I guess, because I was just going through my father's World War II photographs. He went through, it was after D-Day, I'm not sure when, and then the photographs all the way through, he was in the Battle of the Bulge, it was at Remagen Bridge, and was in the Army of Occupation. And this is helping me because he's not here any longer to help me place these photographs in context. Mm. So I really appreciate this book, and I'm enjoying it very much.
Thank you for that, Nancy.
This must be gratifying for you to hear that so many people are really, your book just came out and they're reading it page by page and remembering their fathers who served.
Yes, it's very gratifying. It's number one on the New York Times nonfiction list. It'll be out in another week or so. That may be the most gratifying thing. It's I'm not writing really for the veterans. There are 1.3 million of the 16 million still alive, but this is more for the generations that follow, the veterans' children, their grandchildren, perhaps even their great-grandchildren, to have a clearer understanding of what that generation went through, good and ill. They all have feet of clay. The notion that all the brothers were valiant and all the sisters were virtuous is nonsense. And I think understanding clearly precisely what it is that they did, and in some cases, as with Nancy, having an idea of the trail that your father has followed during that extraordinary time, I find indeed very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. You wrote it for all time. You have said that it's 70 years later, but it so imprints us. Almost everything about American society is affected, you say, by World War II.
It's really quite remarkable. It's not only the greatest story of the 20th century, it's the greatest political event, I think, of the 20th century, in the sense that our feelings about race, for example, we have a segregated military in World War II, and yet there are 53 quote-unquote colored platoons that are integrated into white divisions because they're desperate for riflemen after the Battle of the Bulge. And there are black communities at home agitating, pointing out the disparity between the ostensible reasons for fighting this war, the things that we believe in, and the segregation that exists both at home and in the military. Now, that is a very difficult genie to put back in the bottle afterwards. Our feelings about gender, about the role of women in our society, the opportunities for women. We had millions of women go to work outside the home for the first time. That is a very difficult genie to put back into the bottle. So there's our feelings about the role of the United States in the world. We're no longer isolationist the way we were before 1941. So I really believe that the America of 2013 is deeply shaped and imprinted by what happened during the war.
Mm-hmm. Time for one more phone call. Tom in Algoma. Hi.
Yes, I first want to thank your guest for his resolve and focus in these three works. And also that I want to compliment on his great and detailed footnotes. My only question would be, what was the most significant blunder the Allies had done in 44, 45? We'll take the answer off the air.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Well, there were a number of blunders. Welcome to war. I think, you know, one of the most heartbreaking is the operation known as Market Garden. It was a plan put together by Field Marshal Montgomery to try to outflank the Germans. There was a belief that the Germans had stiffened after their rout from Normandy. And this plan was extremely bold. It involved dropping three airborne divisions into the Netherlands, and a large armored column was then going to move through the airheads that these divisions formed. It's the battle known as a bridge too far. It was not well conceived, as we can see in retrospect, and despite the extraordinary courage of those who fought there, it didn't go well, and the battle really is lost on the first day in September 1944 when they don't capture or replace all of the bridges that need to be captured or replaced in order to outflank the Germans. I think when you look at that particular battle, Operation Market Garden, you can say among the failures, and they would include the Hürtgen Forest and intelligence failures before the Bulge and so on, this one was significant.
Thank you so much for being with us and for this enormously important body of work, Rick. I appreciate your time and your knowledge.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you.
Our guest this part of the program, Rick Atkinson, his last in the trilogy. This is volume 3 of the Liberation Trilogy at the top of the New York Times nonfiction list, he said, which is terrific. The book is The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe, 1944 to 1945. He is the author of two other books in this trilogy and has won all kinds of awards, and you can see why. We're going to continue. We're marking Memorial Day today because on Monday, during these hours from 9 to 11, we are proud to present a documentary about the Wisconsin Medal of Honor recipient Richard Bong. Mike Simonson will join us to talk about that in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On Monday, Memorial Day, during the hours of 9 to 11, we are pleased to be presenting a documentary that has been 10 years in the making. Mike Simonson, our reporter in Superior, Wisconsin, has put together a two-hour-long documentary titled Forever Ace, The Richard Bong Story, and it has won awards already. It's about World War II Ace of Aces fighter pilot Richard Bong. He's featured in this documentary, and what is remarkable about him is the number of enemy aircraft that he shot down, and what is remarkable about Mike Simonson is that he has spent 10 years putting together this documentary, and Mike is joining us to talk more about it. Again, it airs on Monday from 9 until 11. Mike Simonson, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Why did you decide that this story was worth all of your attention for so many years? What is it that is totally captivating about Bong?
There haven't been any movies about this hero. There have been some books, but they've been kind of on the technical side. The Bong Heritage Center in Superior opened in about 10 years ago, 11 years ago, and it just seemed that there is such a story to be told here about a farm boy from Poplar who did such a remarkable thing. And, you know, he grew up, I talked to people, his best friends, and, you know, nobody saw a hero in him. They saw he's a good guy, you know. But his story, in spite of his heroics, is such a story of the people who serve our country back in World War II, but also today. It's just, you know, folks from all over the country who decide that they want to serve.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about how extraordinary he was, Mike, as a pilot.
He was known for not missing. He killed 40 Japanese targets, all had to be in the air. It doesn't count if they're on the ground. He'd get in real close. He'd just go right up their tail and have the bursts, and that would eliminate the aircraft. That would destroy the aircraft, and he would do that without wasting ammunition. So either he was frugal or nearsighted, but he was extremely aggressive. So many of the stories about him, you know, choir boy, teetotaler, you know, baseball, hockey, just all-American boy, and that's true, but he was also extraordinarily aggressive without being careless. This guy was smart, and this guy wanted to end the war, and he wanted to go home. That's what he kept saying over and over again when people said, well, you know, why are you being so aggressive out there?
Hmm. You described him as a farm boy from Poplar. Where did he acquire all the skills that it took to do what he did?
He always loved to fly. President Calvin Coolidge had the summer White House in 1928 in Superior. He fished the Brule River. There'd be a carrier plane going over the Poplar Farm twice a day with mail for the president, and that's when Richard Bong really got hooked on playing. He said, I want to do that, and he was only 8 years old at the time.
Was he hooked on Calvin Coolidge?
I don't know. I think there might have been some Republican leanings there. You know, he's a very quiet and soft-spoken guy and wasn't political. But I tell you what, the people I talked to in this documentary made pilgrimages to the Bong Heritage Center to pay homage to him because, of course, he died in 1945 testing a jet plane. And these people just felt like they had to come up here. And so there was his mechanic who came from Alabama, his tent mate who came from Brooklyn, his wingman from Iowa, which is a composite of how you get all these people together from totally different backgrounds, and they got together and they're cohesive and they really bonded.
People also came, you have said, historians from the Australian War Museum, from the U.S. Air Force Academy.
Right, mate. You know, he called me mate and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the Australians, their story, and a lot of times the whole Pacific War is kind of secondary to what happened, you know, against Hitler and the Fortress Europe and stuff. But the Pacific was kind of underreported and still is. Mm-hmm. But the Australians are really underreported. Australia, when Bong got there, was about to be invaded by Japan. It was the Australians and the Americans together that stopped that, and it stopped the advance of the Japanese. But they were in the most primitive conditions in jungles where they just plowed airstrips. And I mean, one of the guys I talked to described 20-foot pythons and crocodiles, you know, the terrible insects and this is what they were fighting to get at the Japanese.
We were talking about the number of people who served and the number of World War II vets who are dying each day, and it's a huge number, 800 or something every single day. You have done this over 10 years, so you were able to talk to a lot of people who I'm sure some of them are past now. Or
yes.
Because you've done this for 10 years, right?
Right, yeah. His widow, I spoke to her a year before she passed away. Mm. I've lost track with the tent mate and the mechanic, but his wingman, Ralph Wandry, is still alive and well. And I got to tell you, this guy is sharp, and he is funny. And he was taking just one quick story about Richard Bong. This guy had a sense of humor, and he loved mischief. So he wasn't, you know, the perfect, you know, guy that has been whitewashed by history. Ralph Wandry's plane crashed landing, and it just blew up in flames. And Bong and his, you know, friends, they were horrified, but they, you know, okay, you know, they checked. Yeah, he didn't get out. And in fact, he did. And he walked to the mess tent and got in there, and everybody at Bong said, what are you doing here, Wandry? And he said, well, I'm hungry. I want something to eat. You know, what do you think I'm doing here? And then Bong said, I suppose you want your jacket back. And Wandry looked at Bong's jacket, and it had R.H. Wandry on it. They'd already divided his stuff up.
Oh, my. We're greatly looking forward and delighted we can air your documentary on Monday, Mike.
I'm glad you can do that.
Yes.
I'm pleased.
I am too. Very pleased. Thank you. Thanks for the work. Thanks for what you do.
Happy Memorial Day.
Thank you, and to you as well. Mike Simonson, his documentary, I urge you to listen, Forever Ace, The Richard Bong Story, will air on Monday, Memorial Day. perfect time for it, of course, important time for it, from 9 to 11. We urge you to listen. Mike Simonson has already won awards, first place National Headliner Award this spring for his documentary. He does good work. Listen, Monday at 9. So that's it for this first hour of our program this Thursday. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this program. KP is our new producer who's come here from Vermont, though he has strong Midwestern ties. We thank him for on-air production as well. News is coming up. We'll return.